Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The Pharmacist of Auschwitz is the little-known story of Victor Capicius, a Bayer pharmaceutical salesman from Romania who at the age of 35 joined the Nazi SS in 1943 and quickly became the chief pharmacist at the largest death camp, Auschwitz. Based in part on previously classified documents, Patricia Posner exposes Capicius' reign of terror at the camp, his escape from justice fueled in part by his theft of gold ripped from the mouths of corpses, and how a handful of courageous survivors and a single brave prosecutor finally brought him to trial for murder 20 years after the end of the war. The Pharmacist of Auschwitz is much more, though, than a personal account of Capicius. It provides a spellbinding glimpse inside the devil's pact made between the Nazis and Germany's largest conglomerate, IG Farben, and its Bayer pharmaceutical subsidiary. The story is one of murder and greed with its roots in the dark heart of the Holocaust. It is told through Nazi henchmen and industrialists turned war criminals, intelligence agents and zealous prosecutors, and intrepid concentration camp survivors and Nazi hunters. Set against a backdrop ranging from Hitler's war to conquer Europe to the Final Solution to post-war Germany's tormented efforts to confront its dark past, Posner shows the appalling depths to which ordinary men descend when they are unrestrained by conscience or any sense of morality. The Pharmacist of Auschwitz is a moving saga that lingers long after the final page. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Pharmacist of Auschwitz, The Untold Story, with my special guest journalist and author, Patricia Posner. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Patricia Posner.
Oh, good evening, Dan. Thank you very much for having me and letting me tell my story. Very much appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This is a great privilege here and very interested to have this and profile this very incredible book. Let's start with 1986, how you came to – you're the co-author of 12 books.
Well, I'm not really an author. I mean, an unofficial co-author. My husband is really the author of the books, and I just do the research, editing, archive work. I mean, we do as much as I do on his books, he did with me on this book. This book would not be possible without him. So I think that's the way I have to look at it. So everything I've learned from him. But getting to, you mean 1986, how the book came about?
Yes, and what brought you here?
That's when Gerald wrote the book on Mengele, and it was finally published. And that was an interesting time because I had not met Rolf Mengele, which is Joseph Mengele's son, the angel of death from, you know, Auschwitz. And he had said in a couple of meetings that he wanted to, you know, meet me because Gerald was meeting with him because they were going to do an appearance on the Phil Donahue show, for anyone that remembers the Phil Donahue show before that, the other type of shows came out, the crazy reality shows. He was still doing some good stuff. And I was very apprehensive at the time to meet with him. And basically, just to give you a little bit of background on that, why was that I'm British, obviously, and I was brought up in London as a conservative Jew. And my family wouldn't even buy anything German. I was bullied at school, you know, dirty Jew, all Jews have big noses, all Jews have big feet, head down the toilet, swastikas on the desk. So I was brought up in that kind of environment where everybody, also in the family, participated in World War II, whether it was liberating camps, driving an ambulance, in London, doing evacuation work. So my apprehension, I kept on thinking, can I really do this? Can I meet this man? And I was worried, as crazy as this sounds, what would my mother think? You know, what would my mother think of me? You know, and being that, you know, Mengele was the most notorious Nazi in Auschwitz for his medical experiments and selecting hundreds of thousands to die. Even though I know intellectually the son was not to blame for this, I just still was not. But eventually, you know, I decided I would go. And in fact, you know, I said to Gerald, we have to meet somewhere that no one will see me and know who I am or know who he was. So we met in the Plaza Hotel. There was Trader Vic's there. And we met in this dark corner. And we sat down, and really, we were both so uncomfortable. You could tell we were as nervous as could be. I mean, but, you know, everything quickly started to dissolve in front of us. It melted away. And, you know, I was looking at him and thinking, you know, what must he think? This is the man that might have the DNA from, might have passed along to him from his father. So during the course of when we were chatting, he started telling Gerald, you know, and myself, how his father escaped. And he mentioned only a few months after the war had ended that his father had gotten safe haven in Munich from a pharmacist with whom he had served on the Eastern Front before he was transferred to Auschwitz. And Rolf said that his father's old colleagues had helped him despite knowing all the gruesome stuff that had taken place there, and that he had been friends with somebody else that worked at Auschwitz called Victor Capesius, and he was the pharmacist. And I, you know, was like, wow, a pharmacist. There was, I don't know why I didn't think to myself at that time there would be a pharmacist in Auschwitz, but it was, I was really taken back by it. And later on the walk home, I, you know, Joe and I, we talked about this. And, of course, in those days, you couldn't just come home and go on your iPad or your computer and Google it and see who they were, or get maybe Wikipedia on it or something. So I stored it in the back of my head and decided one day I would revisit this story. And that's basically how it all started.
Now, this story Victor Capesius, no problem, thank you. The story of Victor Capesius, you talk about his roots in he's not a native German, so his roots in Romania, which explains so many things later in the story. So tell us a little bit about his background and, interestingly, where he was born.
Interesting part about Capesius is that, he wasn't political. That was the other thing about him. There were no signs of political. You know, before the war, he represented this emerging, you know, educated middle class Romanians from a German family. There were a lot of what they called ethnic Germans in Romania, and he studies in Romania. Then in Vienna, he gets a pharmacy degree, and his focus, as I said before, more on business, not on politics. I did not find in any of my research at the beginning there was anything there about anti-Semitism or any of that type of stuff. Or, but he lands a job in Romania with Bayer, owned by the industrial conglomerate IG Farben, and he's a national sales rep. He actually came, though, from Transylvania, which is funny, you know, the famous town of Dracula. That's where he started. And that's where he's a national sales rep. And he has, remember, which is interesting because you've read the book, so you know this so well. He has, you know, many Jewish clients and doctors and pharmacists and medical clinicians, even, you know, textile manufacturers because of the dyes who needed the Bayer dyes. So he was around all of these people. And although some of his friends are rabid, as I said before, anti-Semites, he does not show any hostility towards the Jews. And then, very interesting, as you know, he marries a woman that's half Jewish, that actually becomes Lutheran afterwards, but it's half Jewish. So it's a very odd situation there.
Now, but you also talk about the sentiment that's prevalent in Romania at that time, and you say is also other satellite countries from Russia. So tell us what the sentiment was towards Jewish people there, and then at the same time, where he is born,
A lot of the anti-Semitic, it's a long history of hatred. I mean, it's hundreds of years. I mean, I don't know where, if it starts, you know, all the way back to the killing of Christ, but it's definitely, there is this fever of rabid anti-Semites that, even though he was around that environment, there's no doubt, it still did not seem to bring it into his area. I mean, as I said before, he married a woman that was half Jewish. I mean, but the anti-Semitic problem isn't something new. I mean, as you've read, I've written in there, it's just that it's, you know, Transylvania was a home of, what, the oldest Jewish communities, tracing its roots back to what? I can't remember 100%. I think it's 87 AD, something like that. But historically, it suffered with surges of anti-Semitism in and out. And though much of Europe had benefited, you know, by this, it's just if you read the history, I think, through, there's nowhere pinpointing, but it always relies back, you know, to if you go into the money lending part, as I said, the Christ, killing of Christ. I think there's so many. It's inbred into these people, and it goes through generations. And we're going through a resurgence of it now.
Right. Yeah, certainly. Now, you talk about Capesius' career being interrupted in 1943, obviously, for service in the German army.
Mm-hmm.
And you write that he thought it was more honorable to serve Germany rather than Romania.
Yes.
And he had three daughters by that time, young daughters. So tell us a little bit about, as you do, that he spent a lot of time proving his Aryan ancestry. Tell us how he qualifies for this to be an SS in the combat unit, how this comes to be.
Well, he has to, you know, prove he has German ancestry, obviously, and for at least three generations. So as long as he can prove that he had three generations of ancestry, and then that is part of the process. And I'm very proud of it. I mean, not
so
everybody got to be in the SS. So, you know, for him to be in the SS was very high. I mean, he got his blood tattoo under his arm and everything, and you bragged about that. And he bragged about it, I should say, to friends.
Now, you talk about Auschwitz, and you talk about the other camps that are set up, the concentration camps, and so then you also get to talking about Auschwitz itself and how Capesius comes to be stationed at Auschwitz, because he's not first stationed there. So tell us about his journey to get to Auschwitz and his original reaction when he finds out he's going there.
Well, Auschwitz was not, he was originally in Dachau, and Auschwitz was not what, you know, it's a strange thing to say, but it wasn't one of those places that you would say, oh, that's where I want to be transferred. It wasn't a desire, because people knew that it was a death camp and what was going on there. So it wasn't one of the most desired, all the diseases, everything. It was not the assignment you would want to go to. So after several months of, he found out he was to be transferred there, he tried his hardest to fight to not go. And, you know, for his bad luck as it was, he tried his hardest and it didn't happen. So for several weeks they said no, and they eventually got sent there. I think it was near Christmas, 1943, and he was not happy at all about it.
You also,
I mean,
say that
around
his...
what Auschwitz was like, so they all knew. I mean, you knew this was not the assignment you wanted to go to. It was a true death camp.
Now, what was his assignment?
No extra pay, you know, no extra rations, no extra. The summers were brutal. The winters were brutal. There were many illnesses there. So it just, you know, it was not a desirable place to be transferred to.
You write about Dr. Edward Wirths, that's the commander there, or the head pharmacist, someone in charge there. As you write, tell us what his mental state is and why he is dismissed eventually. This is a fascinating story. And tell us what Capesius's role is there, his duties are, as soon as he gets to that camp.
Well, I mean, Worth. You mean Worth? That was the chief pharmacist was executed for spreading disinformation. I mean,
sure.
Defeatism. I'm sorry, for defeatism. I mean, that's when Capesius takes over, and that is. His role there, he becomes head pharmacist, you know, and he's dispensing all the medications used in medical experiments. He also was distributing the colorless, odorless insecticide, that Cyclone B, that was used as the poison for the gas chambers. And so from taking over from there, you know, it was, for him, you know, I don't think he really realized what it was going to be like at the time. And I think someone like Worth, who despised being there anyway, it was very hard for him. And it was, you know, I think one of them called it, Chroma, I think it was called, it was like Dante's Inferno. It was the underworld. It was nothing to compare it to. It was like Sodom and Gomorrah.
Right. You don't spare the reader any details in this, and that just adds to this profound worth of this. But you talk about the experiments, and you talk about Mengele being there at a certain time, and Mengele gleefully volunteering to be the kind of person that was at the selection process, who would live and who would die. Capesius.
Well, Mengele was, go ahead, sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, Mengele was, you know, there's not really, one cannot really compare Mengele to Capesius. This is different. I mean, I actually think that for Mengele, though the actual place was dreadful for him, it was a good assignment for him because he needed people for experiments. And so he, for him, he had a selection there. I mean, it was just like, it's like a scientist gone mad, almost, in that respect. So for him, he could do everything. He was just let loose. He could do whatever he needed to be done, and whether it's experimenting on eyes, you know, making the perfect Aryan race, obviously, where, I mean, they were wanted the twins so they could multiply for World War II as well, you know, so the Aryan race could be plentiful, and the blonde hair. I mean, I remember when I went to the Berlin Document Center in quite a few years ago, they had charts up of what they considered should be the perfect Aryan race, and that's exactly what he was trying to get. You know, I mean, you've got to remember Mengele, who even volunteered for extra shifts, you know, and there were about 5,000 twins and many children that eventually passed through there that were, I mean, it was called Mengele Zoo. You know, the barracks 14, Camp F, there, you know, it was conducted some of the worst, gruesome experiments you could ever imagine. And no anesthesia, nothing. And it's so, coming back to Capesius, it was a different type of thing. You know, he was a pharmacist. He really wasn't a doctor being there. And his assignment was completely different. And it was only when they needed the doctors to start choosing the life and death, as you said, left to die and right to live. I mean, what was right to live, though, really? Was it really to live? Was it to be in a slave labor camp where they would work you to death or starve you to death? Was it to be a sex slave? I mean, really, it really wasn't life. I mean, I look at Auschwitz as one enormous death camp with a graveyard. You know, it was death and money, really. That's what it's all about there. And I think what happened to a lot of them there, like Capesius, is that, you know, you're there a week and it makes you feel physically ill and you probably want to throw up and you think, I can't do any of this. And then 1 week becomes a month and a month becomes 2 months, 3 months. And you just start getting used to it. It becomes normal for you. That becomes your everyday. You wake up in the morning, this is your life. This is what you have to adapt to. And the people become less than human to you. I mean, when you think of it, Hitler had more respect for animals than he had for humans, in the respect that he was a vegetarian and he didn't believe in vivisection, which was experiments on animals. You could die or you could be put to death or put in prison. So, you know, these people are less than human. And remember, just next door to Auschwitz was an enormous slave labor factory run by Farben, Capesius, you know, pre-war employee. So it's amazing when you think of it that way. Monowitz, that was.
As you write in the book, you clearly explain the connection R.G. Farben, its subsidiary Bayer, in Nazi Germany. You say 8 years before Hitler rose to power, the company was formed. You talk about the incredible money, $55 billion in 2015 currency for their expansion. So explain what Farben was, and you talk about how many Jewish scientists were involved in this company, an essential part of the company, according to its owner. And so tell us how it came to be that there were no more Jewish doctors, scientists.
You know, Hitler just had such a hatred towards the Jews. I mean, for one to really understand where that came from, I mean, many people have tried to analyze it, find out, you know, say why. And I think you remember there's one part in the book where they come to him and they say, but if we get rid of all of them, we'll be, you know, put back 100 years. And he said, fine, we'll be put back 100 years. I don't care. So he, you know, he wanted no, he was Judenfrei, Jewish free. And so that meant he didn't care. He just wanted Jews out. That was the beginning and the end of it. And he got his way there. There's no doubt about it. And then, you know, and Farben, you know, as you said, was, you know, was founded in 1925. In the first decade as a new company, it became the world's largest chemical company and also the most profitable firm in Germany. It was the fourth biggest conglomerate in the world, and I think it claimed a record of 4 Nobel Prizes in chemistry and medicine. So Hitler and the Nazi had a love-hate relationship with Farben, and as we get back to that, had you know, had all these Jewish scientists, so it was a real love-hate relationship, and it was important for him to kick all the Jews from the labs out, and he did it. And they were by 1938, they were out, and then they needed an enormous plant, and everything in that Nazi war effort, they needed a plant, they needed somewhere to found, so they found the perfect spot, which was Monowitz, which was in Poland and only 4 miles from Auschwitz. So, you know, it's Hitler wanted self-sufficiency, and that basically was because he was so angry about World War One, what went down, that he wanted to be self-sufficient, you know, in rubber, in everything. He didn't want to rely on anyone or anything, and that was part of the factory. And, I mean, it was... that's basically it in a nutshell.
You talk about this company in particular consorting with the Nazis in that they complied with the race laws, but they also were, the German government was ready to bankroll them, and they thought it was such an incredible investment given this slave labor that this was going to be an incredible profit center, so they refused. But they were, as you explain, and I'll have you explain, how they really do become a Nazi company.
Well, they become a Nazi, you know, it's Nazified. You become a Nazi, you know, you have to go through, first of all, there has to be no Jews in the company. And then you are Nazified. You are part of, you know, Hitler's special group or whatever. But it wasn't just them. It was other companies that went through that. And therefore, you abide by their rules, their regulations. You pay certain monies. And, I mean, when you think of it, it was like almost like this mad thing that just went through, the whole country, and everybody complied with it. That's what's so amazing. Everybody complied with it. No one fought or said, and those that did fight, I mean, one doesn't really hear about, but you don't know. I mean, it was really, I mean, I think it was... many of the company officials have become, as I said before, Nazified, and they were members of, I mean, they joined what they called the SS. And so Farben was successfully got a certificate that it was part of this German firm and company, and they were Aryanites, you know. So I think they dismissed about all over, because you had to get rid of everyone, even if it was in parts of Europe, 107 department heads that worked in the international division. Outside of Germany, that was.
But you talk about even more responsibility, because other companies might have been Nazified, the process being completed. These company complained about the slave labor treatment by the Germans. They said they were sadistic, so they proposed to have their own concentration camp.
Yes,
and with that concentration camp,
it's three.
And you talk about the, of course, not immediately they being necessarily death camps, but the conversion, of course, when the final solution comes. But between that, you talk about the company profiting incredibly from Zyklon B,
Zyklon
the pesticide
B, yeah.
that they use
that
they used to exterminate people at the camps. And then
Well, the Zyklon B, I was going to say, which is interesting, you bring that up as a very good example because there is an amazing story about that. They wanted to stretch. I mean, like anything, it was about money. And, the Nazis made profit off of death. So they decided, let's cut down on the cans. And they made profit out of death from everything, whether it was hair, leather shoes, slave labor, selling the inmates, the test drugs, collecting cash, jewelry, gold, and they would, be shipped out. But with the Zyklon B, they decided to bring down the amount that they used. And because of their inventory, they wanted to bring it down. They wanted to reduce so we could reduce their expenses. So for each canister for 5 Reichmarks, which would be $2, the SS had begun experimenting with using less at the gassing. Instead of 20 canisters, they need to kill up to 2,000 prisoners. The SS dropped the number to 15. And that extended that gruesome 20 minutes and the time that lasted for a few to die, and it just didn't work for them because I don't know if you read the story about the young girl that they found underneath the bodies.
Yes.
Are you familiar with, the poison used, this is a poison that Farben had, it was their pattern. It was, it was an insecticide. So when they went to the gas chamber, one day what actually happened, I think if I explain the story, you'll see why they went back to their normal amount of gas, Zyklon B again. One day with Sonderkommando, right? They're the Jews that were assigned to the horrible task of removing the dead bodies from the gas chambers. And they found a young girl, around about 15, and she was still alive between a mountain of bodies in the gas chamber, and she was still moving. And they summoned in an inmate doctor, Nishli, who went running with the doctor's bag into the gas chamber, and she was like leaning against the wall, and her body was half covered, because it's naked. But he recounted this story, that she looked like a wonderfully beautiful angel breathing her last breath lying there. And they managed to free her body from the others, and they carried it into a room where the Sonderkommando used to change their clothes. And he laid her down on a bench and gave her like several shots of the shots are not clear, but to try and shock her heart back. And the men covered her shivering body, and it was almost like they were taking care of their own child. And someone ran to the kitchen to get some tea or soup, and they were fighting for her life. But then, all of a sudden, the Nazi doctors started treating her. They worried that she would remember what had happened. And that really, really scared them. And they talked about it. And they said, what we do? She'll go outside. She'll talk to the people in the camp. She'll destabilize it. We're going to have a lot of problems. Because at that point, people still really didn't know. They really thought some of the new members that were coming thought they were going, to have a shower. And so it was too great a risk for them. So they took her outside and shot her in the back of the head. And that was the experiment of using less Zyklon B.
Yeah, incredible.
So I know. It really takes your breath away, I know.
Certainly. And to add this, even worse, if it can be, is you talk about Capesius, and we alluded to it. What does he do with the people that come? You say they're hiding sometimes all of their valuables. They don't know they're going to die, so they've got all of their family jewels and valuables.
You're absolutely
and sometimes
right.
money. What does Capesius specialize in?
Well, you know, what it was in the beginning, what Capesius was meant to do in the beginning, he was meant to dispense all the medication used in the medical experiments, and he stored and distributed the colorless, odorless Cyclone B. So that was basically his, and he performed the life and death, yes, but he was also meant to go to the front when they came off of the trains. He was meant to go up front and look for medicines, because these people truly believed that they truly believed they were being relocated, and that's why they brought these big sacks of so many kilos. And not that you can imagine or I can imagine, but if you thought you were being relocated, you would bring everything that was important to you. So yes, they would bring money, jewelry. Obviously, they would bring their Shabbos candles, their Friday night candles, everything, you know, silver, gold, everything that meant something to them. And he went from taking the medicines, taking possibly equipment that might have been brought forward. He started taking all their possessions. You've got a small mountain of personal belongings left at each train, and he was just rabid about it. He began just searching instead for valuables. He became like a greedy thief. And then, to be even worse, he started taking the gold from the teeth, which is just horrific. The Nazis assigned several inmate dentists to these ghastly tasks of pulling the gold teeth from the mouths of the corpses, because everything to Nazis was money. So if you had 65 to 70 pounds of gold a day coming out, and you think of that, and it doesn't seem possible. But as I said earlier, everything, was money to them, whether it was hair. They worked from the bunker between the gas chambers and the crematorium in pulling this stuff out. And in 1944, when Auschwitz was struggling to keep up with the enormous numbers of Hungarian Jews arriving, and then they began really to get gassed, and more dentists had to be assigned to pull out more gold teeth. And all the pulled gold was crammed into large trunks, stored under the camp's chief, dentist, who coincidentally happened to share the same office building as Capesius in the pharmacy. So it was a hideous collection. And then Capesius started stealing it and sending it back to his sister in Vienna. And witnesses, described the suitcases and trunks filled with gold, sometimes even still on the dentures with pieces. I'm sorry to be so graphic here, but even with some of the jaw, hanging from it and the flesh sticking to some of it and reeking, smelling terribly of decomposition, And one of the inmates that worked for Capesius saw him, digging through the stinking mess and pulling out dentures and trying to eliminate what he needed there. So it's quite ghastly.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a break to talk about Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country, and Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Now, Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States, and as a result, seafood is sourced sustainably, beef, chicken, and pork come from responsibly raised animals, and produce is sourced from farms that practice regenerative farming. And Blue Apron can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S. Featured upcoming meals this week are crispy salmon and roasted potato salad with pickled mustard seeds and creme fraiche sauce. Now, it sounds gourmet. It is gourmet. I put this all together myself, and it was delicious, and it was easy to do. It's affordable. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make your own delicious home-cooked meals. There's a variety of new recipes each week, or you can let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. Customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. Blue Apron has several delivery options, so you can choose what fits your needs, and there's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. There's a guarantee for Blue Apron's freshness guarantee, promises every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook or they'll make it right. Now check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/murder. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/murder. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Now, Tricia, we were talking about Capesius and his incredible, almost demonic behavior here, knowing no remorse or bounds or morality whatsoever. But we also talk about the step up for the Nazis and some people coming from a place where Victor Capesius was born. And we talk about an incredible story of Joseph Gluck and his family and his 16-year-old nephew. Please tell us a little bit about this.
It's really interesting you should bring that up. So I was just thinking about that because I was going to say, remember, one of the most interesting things about Capesius is that Auschwitz, when he did the selections in 1944, the Jews arriving were from his native country. So he had worked with them, and they recognized him. And you mentioned Gluck. But there was also that, you know, there were so many of, you know, when they saw him, I mean, I'll get to Gluck, you know, they would think, oh, there's Capesius. He's going to save us. We're going to be fine. You know, everything's going to be fine. And he separated all these families up, which is amazing, really. He had become, as we said, less than human. He just did not... you were talking about Joseph Gluck. Joseph Gluck was a textile manufacturer from Kleisberg, and he got to Auschwitz on his transportation of 2,800 Jews, and I'm not sure. I think it was like in June, and he was with his wife and his 2-year-old twins, and his mother and his sister-in-law, and so he, you know, he thought if he could just get, you know, the eye of Capesius, and to help him, you know, save him or his family, he didn't want to be separated, and to his astonishment, when he did see this SS officer, that it was Capesius, you know, and to think that, you know, maybe he could save him. Because at that point, they could see people were being separated from each other, but they didn't know that when they were there, that the right or the left meant death or survive, as we said before, in the horrific situation. But he was trying to get the eye, you know, because, you know, again, Hungary, you know, Capesius, do you know, he wanted to say to him, you know, do you like your work? Capesius said, nothing else. And so it was, he remembered him so well. And so it just didn't seem, I think it was, there was a lot of confusion there at the time. I mean, you have to understand, they've been in these cattle carts. With no food, no water, nothing. So, you know, they come out, it's bright out there, they can't believe it. So they thought, you know, so Gluck himself, his wife and sister-in-law, so he sent Gluck's wife and sister-in-law to the right, and after that, I don't think Gluck ever saw them again. And for Gluck's twins, they were dispatched immediately to the gas chamber, where I think at one point, Capesius was going to go to Mengele and ask if he needed them for an experiment, but they did not. So it was a horrible situation, just a horrible. And there was, you know, Gluck, his 16-year-old nephew was seized before him. The SS took him away, and he managed to cut his arm with blood, and he wrote on the back of the wall of the barracks, you know, his name. Andrew lived here at 16 years of age. So families were just broken up. In such a cold, heartless manner, and there was no real rhyme or reason. I mean, they say, if you read the documents, they say, well, who looked like he or she could work, the, you know, would be a good worker, would not be a good worker. But sometimes, really upstanding, like healthy-looking people would just be sent straight to death. So it was almost like on a whim how they felt that day.
Wow. You talk about, and I don't know if everyone knows this, but this is a harsh reminder. In 1943, you talk about the Nazi momentum throughout the world ended. And it was a 5-month Russian siege. But you talk about in May, between May 14th and July 7th, 1944, it was the bloodiest period of all. 288,000 Jews arrived.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about this initiative and the Final Solution and Capesius and others at Auschwitz, what they knew about what was happening, what they felt. Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, you know, as you're talking about, you know, the deportations and the Final Solution is the deportations, and well, there was such a from Hungary, you know, there was the deportations were from Hungary, and they were so they couldn't gas and kill enough at the time to just really, it became like a frenzy there, and it was, I think, the disbelief of what was going on, and the whole feeling of what are we going to do now, and how are we going to deal with all of these people. It became almost like a how many people can we gas? How many were? Everybody was almost in, you know, the ultimate, you know, boost over. It was like a 10. Although the Nazis would ultimately boast that over a hellish 10 weeks that spring that they killed half of all the Jews and they gassed, you know, Auschwitz. The flood of prisoners proved to be too much even for them to do the mass murders. I mean, that's why they were shooting some of them in the head. And just, you know, it was just like a craziness. There were 800,000 Jews when the German intelligence reported to Hitler in March of 1944. And I mean, it's just, and that the Hungarian leaders were secretly negotiating in surrendering to the Allies. So it was really, the transportation started in mid-May initially with 4 daily. I mean, each packed about 3,000 Jews. It was wildly ambitious, even by their standards of German killing.
Yeah, and you talk about also the situation with Capesius's private life, where his wife and his daughters are still in Romania, and the anti-Semitic tide or the support for Germany has ended, and they're switched sides to the Allies, and their situation is in peril at the same time. So he has a few things going on, despite his coolness. And this guy seems to maintain that for many, many, many years. His life is in chaos for the first time, isn't it?
It's a lot of pressure for him, but he never shows the stress. I mean, because remember, you know, he never shows the stress. I mean, not that I can ever see. And he always believes he's the victim anyway in every situation. So he seemed, you know, at times completely unflappable to me anyway. And, yes, you're right about the 3 children. And no one describes him in getting angry or emotional. There's no descriptions anywhere of that, which is very interesting when you think of it. There's no. He's always very stoic in that respect.
Now, he's also, what's, again, interesting is that there is word that he has a mistress, which is a inmate.
Yeah.
A Jewish inmate named Eva Citron Bard.
Yeah, who he allows to grow her hair a little longer than anybody else. Yeah, I know. I mean, that is the that was what I mean, that's how it appeared to me, definitely. Which is, yeah, because it comes back to the, you know, what we were talking about earlier. He didn't have a thing about being anti-Semitic. He was just doing his duty, right? So, but it was a well-placed rumor at that time. I think she was about, he was, what, 37 years old, and supposedly she was 26, and she was an inmate pharmacy, because they used to, if you were lucky, you would get to work in the pharmacy, and that would be a great job to have. And she was Jewish, obviously, and I think she was from Transylvania. And he casually known, I think they say that he casually knew her before the war, and she had been selected during her summer of 45 for arrival by Dr. Klein and Mengele. And only after like a few weeks, I began working in the pharmacy and the dispensary. And Capetius became, you know, quite good friends with her.
Yeah. As the tide turns in this war, you also talk about the desperate effort for the Nazis to at least try at Auschwitz and other locations and other death camps to cover their tracks. You say they couldn't kill enough people fast enough. So what did they try to do with the documentation, and how successful were they?
We have to be grateful. I mean, to what you just said, we have to be grateful for one thing, that the Germans were excellent when it came to documents. But they were very proficient with all that stuff. But they started, they started dismantling everything, you know, trying to get rid of all the evidence in November of 44. And they used about 200 inmates, half of them were women, and began destroying the crematoriums, any documents, demolishing units, trying to not leave any evidence behind whatsoever. I mean, fortunately for us, they did. And by January, the Nazi realized it was almost impossible to evacuate all the inmates there, and numbers were overwhelming. There were 600,000 prisoners. And so, you know, they really worked hard at it, but fortunately for us, they left us a lot of documentation. I am grateful for that. They were good at doing that stuff. They were very proficient at that.
You talk about all the rats on the move when they know that the gig is up, and you talk about Mengele even ordering everything to be packed up, even his marble dissecting table and all his papers on twins.
Yeah, that's just amazing, and that is, I think, an amazing story in itself. I mean, not just doing a plug here, but if anyone wants to read a great book on Mengele and his escape and everything, I think they should read my husband's book, Mengele: The Complete Story. It's an amazing book, and it's not about the camps. It's about purely about his escape and how he took all this stuff, you know, how he got everything. But in truckloads and paperwork, and but there was also, as in Auschwitz, there was simply too. The problem was there was just, you know, the word when the word reached Farben, getting back to Farben, in their headquarters, and the Russians had by that time the Russians had seized Monowitz, Fritz Emir, there was simply, you know, what was there was simply too much to destroy, and I think they were, like you said, they were panic-stricken, and employees tossed out stunning 100 tons of documents from their windows into massive courtyards, and some of the papers was burned in large bonfires, while others were, you know, truckloads were crammed into vaults nearby Russian branch, you know, there was a panic everywhere. I mean, it was time to cover up as much as we can. You know, we didn't have anything. And despite that last-ditch effort, the Allies captured a warehouse full of papers when they seized Farben's headquarters. So that was great. But it wasn't just absolute chaos and madness going on then.
The most horrific of this entire modern horror story is that when the prisoners at Auschwitz that were not gassed beforehand, that were not marched to their death beforehand, because these prisoners were left behind, supposedly, because they were too weak. By the time they were liberated, you said there was 800, but incredibly, 400 died within those first 3 days after they were liberated. They could not be saved. It is an incredible, it's so vivid that fact alone, that what they found, they couldn't, it was, the sight that those liberators, the Russians, came and saw, and then later the Americans saw.
Well, when the Red Army entered the camp's perimeter on January 27, they found, I think, 600 unburied corpses, nearly 15,000 prisoners were alive. They were the ones too ill to make the march, as you just said. And even the hardened Red Army troops were startled by these half-dead, almost zombie-like skeletal prisons within the days of liberations. Hundreds died of, whether it was malnutrition, illnesses. And at Monowitz, that's where half of the 800 prisoners behind also died over the days. And it's, you know, it's a weird thing I'm going to say, but at least they died free people, you know. They were free. They were free. You know, it makes me want to cry because they didn't know they were free, or maybe they did, but they were free. I'm sorry for that. But, you know, in a strange way, there was, you know, died freedom. And they found in the warehouses, there was an area, by the way, called Canada, you know, because you've read the book so well, where they would store everything. And the reason it was called a Canada for your listeners, they thought it was some faraway, wonderful place. And they stored everything there. And some of the most stomach-wrenching evidence had happened at that. There were like 837,000 women's dresses, 370,000 suits, you know, 45,000 pairs of shoes, tons of human hair. I mean, can you just imagine what it had to have been like? It just is mind-boggling that they got away with this. And it's just stomach-wrenching when you think of it. And the other thing was they found, which I hadn't even thought about at the time, was, you know, limbs, like, you know, what one uses when one lost a leg or prosthesis. I'm sorry, that's what I was trying to look for. And they were all made out of wood. I mean, it's just, you know, when I had to go through those pictures, I have to tell you, to put it in my book, I just thought I was going to go, I was hysterical at times. I would scream or shout, walk. It was just too much. It was, you know, I understand what you say. It's not an easy book to read, I understand, but it's a really important book to read. And there is a good ending, thank goodness, in some part through two of my heroes. But to write it was unbelievable. It was, as much as I know about World War II, and I'm at an age where, you know, I was born in the 50s, so I've been around a family that talks about it. You still, there's so much you don't know, and it's just, the mind boggles how these people could do this. I mean, so many of them. There were 7,000 of these people that worked at Auschwitz, and Capesius was just one of them. Just one of them. And you think, how did not a bunch of them get together and say, this is madness, let's do something? But no one ever did. They just followed orders. They just followed what they had to do. It was their duty for the Führer. Sorry about that. Went off a bit track. But, you know, it's just too much. It really is.
Well, part of the outrage of this, too, as we continue with this, is that, and we won't be able to go into all of it, but you say right away, again, incredibly, Capesius is on the run. Hitler has killed himself. Capesius is on the run, traveling with four inmate assistants, including Eva Citron Bard.
Eva Citron, yeah.
And so you talk about them on the run, then you talk about him being arrested finally, and so anybody's reading this book thinking, well, certainly there's going to be a prosecution of this, and there's a questionnaire. Tell us about the effort before. Tell us about the effort. What the Allies do, the British, the Americans, who is more vigilant or who is willing to let them or excuse them? And just tell us the mood of the world and what the Allies do and what they do when they finally arrest Capesius.
Well, as you said, he fled Auschwitz and was captured by the British in May, just a few weeks before the war was over. But, you know, there were millions of displaced persons, you know, German soldiers, refugees. There was chaos. There was confusion. You know, Kapp was just a small fry. We're not talking about, like, Mengele. He was on nobody's radar. It wasn't like, oh, we have to get Victor Capesius. You know, it wasn't like Goering or Mengele. Mengele was definitely. And, you know, he was tried in absentia and sentenced to death in Romania. And so the Brits let him go after 1 year. In May of 1946. Then 3 months later, wonderful story this is, a survivor sees him in a Munich train station and reports it. And the Americans arrest him and hold him for 1 year and can't make a case. Then he goes into what they call denazification. You know, he has to be, you know, could you be a good German and go back into society? And they rule he is a major offender, but he gets that reversed, because he lies through the whole denazification. So in 1950, he's free of all of it and gets his drugger's license again and opens a pharmacy And so it's just you know, Germans' attitude about war crimes. Most Germans just wanted to forget about World War II and bury the past. So they felt that a handful of war criminals trials by Americans and British, that was enough punishment. You know, that was fine. And so by 1950, over 2,000 open investigations, and 55, the first year of the German control, only 21. There was no interest in going after Nazi crimes. They wanted to move on.
And you talk about even when they do, when a prosecutor, when they get someone that's interested in prosecution out of all the other prosecutors that aren't, then the sentences are lenient, relatively, mm-hmm. and then they are also commuted to a certain degree. They're let out earlier than possible, so...
Yeah. It's crazy. It's really, I mean, you hit it right in my head. It's crazy. The sentence, you know, when I would be reading the stuff, you know, you really hit on that one. I would read it once or twice, and I would say, Jill, read this. Did I just read this right? They only got so, like, 7 years, 2 years, and then they were like, I mean, it's just, the crimes were so horrific. And it was like a slap on the wrist, wasn't it, really? You know, it was nothing. I mean, it really was quite extraordinary how it just was treated that way, you know. And he followed all this stuff, you know, Capizius as well, because he was watching the Farben trials, you know, at that time as well. And then I think it was by, he was in 1950, he got his license as a druggist from the state, and then he purchased a butcher shop, and soon he made that into, you know, the apothecary. But he also, you know, the Americans High Commission responded to the Germans' plea for clemency and commuted the sentence of about 70% of the convicted Nazis.
Yeah. Now, this guy, like you say, has always been cool as a cucumber, but there have been, as you say, activists and people that won't let this go.
Right.
So you talk about a brave prosecutor as well. So tell us about the conditions that have changed and in which upon this brave prosecutor could get some of the people from the past, this Langbein, if I'm not pronouncing his name right,
Langbein,
some
French, yes.
Really important witnesses and this important
right.
prosecution. How does this come about?
Well, you know, Langbein was one of the first of all, he was a political prisoner at Auschwitz for nearly 4 years and was non-Jewish. And he was relentless in traveling around the world to get sworn statements from survivors, collecting evidence of crimes at camps. He was tireless in punishing reluctant German prosecutors to bring cases against Nazi criminals. And one of them was Josef Mengele, for instance, and that he indicted in 1959. And the only reason was because of him. And one of the names on his list was Victor Capesius. And so, you know, that is a great story. I mean, he was relentless. And then the second major character that was nonstop was Fritz Bauer. And there's just been a movie out recently about Fritz Bauer. A foreign movie it was out, The People versus Fritz Bauer, if anyone's interested. And he was Germany's first post-war Jewish prosecutor. So, you know, pretty amazing. And some, you know, in a sharp contrast to most Germans who prefer to forget about the past, Bauer had himself been, you know, completely, was in the concentration camp. I mean, he was relentless. You know, he would not let bygones be bygones. And as a chief prosecutor in Frankfurt, his dream was to have a grand war crimes trial of Auschwitz defendants, brought by German prosecutors before German judges and under German law. And his dream became true and a reality in 1964 with the start of the famous Frankfurt Auschwitz trials, in which 22 SS men were charged with war crimes, and one of those defendants was none other than Victor Capesius.
You talk about this fight for his life, but I've read a lot of true crime, and I've seen... I read a lot of stuff. Tell us about his behavior at this trial, some of the things that the judge gets him to stop doing.
Yeah, you know, his behavior in the trial is, I mean, if you had to take a still of a movie, and the pictures of him wearing dark glasses, because he said his incarceration hurt his eyes, he was smiling at the trial, he was waving with his hand and talking, and at one point the judge asked what was going on, and he was laughing. I mean, it was so bizarre. You know, it was a puzzlement to everybody, even his own attorney. He just seemed detached from what was going on, from the proceedings. He never showed a moment of regret, sorrow, remorse. As I said earlier, he was always casting himself as the victim. And, you know, like, you know, I was drafted into the SS, you know. I mean, he just was, there was nothing there. There was nothing, nothing, nothing. It was hollow. It was just,
you talk
it,
about
it was really,
one of the reasons, the biggest reasons he does so well in court, because there are, Bauer lays on some very, very serious charges, and he has some serious witnesses, and he has a good,
right,
strong case.
Right.
So where does he get these lawyers, you talk about in the book, where does he get the funds for these lawyers, and what kind of lawyers does he get?
Oh, he got the money from his family. I mean, he had that wasn't an issue for him to have. He had, you know, he had a fund for that. So that was not an issue for Capesius. And there were a lot of you remember he had a pharmacy made a lot of money. He had two. He had the beauty pharmacy and he had the regular pharmacy. He had a great lawyers. He was paying them sufficiently. So that wasn't an issue for him. That was no problem whatsoever. You know, the family made sure he was well taken care of. And, you know, the most damning evidence against him was from more than a dozen camp survivors, as you mentioned before, and had worked with him professionally before the war. And Capesius denied all of those accounts, claiming they confused him with Dr. Fritz Klein. And he looked nothing like Fritz Klein, you know, a Nazi doctor also born in Transylvania. And Capesius claimed that he had told his superiors he did not want to do life and death selections at the railhead, and that instead he bribed Klein to do it for him by giving Klein some extra liquor and food. So when I did my research, I found that the survivors scoffed at that idea, that they had confused Klein with Capesius. The two didn't look remotely alike. They didn't resemble each other, and Capesius was 20 years younger than Klein. So, you know, and also Klein spoke with an accent free of High German, while Capesius spoke German fluently, but noticeably as a foreigner. So, you know, I mean, it's just remarkable. There was no remorse from this man whatsoever, nothing whatsoever. He really didn't think he did anything wrong. That's how that's my conclusion. You know, that's how I felt about it.
It was proven. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. What were you going to say?
He was proven responsible for things as heinous as walking up those stairs and dropping the Zyklon B poison himself into those gas chambers.
Correct.
He was responsible and knew of those experiments. That was proven. And it was
correct,
proven that he robbed the graves of these corpses,
right,
of anything of any kind of value whatsoever.
Right.
And even people he knew, he selected them for life and death.
But right, right.
His lawyers were successful. His lawyers were very successful in this trial, weren't they?
Yeah, they were very successful, but amazingly, you know, he was only one of seven defendants charged with high counts of deliberate murder, like our first-degree murder. And only one of the seven charged with top count was acquitted deliberate murder. So it stunned the prosecutors, who appealed unsuccessfully and convicted of aiding and abetting and only got 9 years. And then he only served 2.5 and he was free by 1986. And, you know, so 1968, I'm sorry. And I think the other chilling part of that story is that when he gets home and he goes to a public event in his hometown, as a bitter, unrepentant, you know, till his death, they started clapping him, applauding him, you know, like he was a hero. I mean, how can you even explain that? You can't.
And his lawyer stooped to to reducing the witnesses at trial, doubting their credibility, their stories, their motivations. And then, like you say, again, it's disgusting in that he had the means to bring his daughters and his wife finally. They joined him at the trial. They went on to successful careers. Ironically, his youngest daughter is a pharmacist.
Right.
Again, success. And tell us what happened.
But,
How did he die?
Just before you say that, but, you know, his lawyer did what any good defense lawyer would do. And he attached the credibility, you know, he attacked the credibility and of the witnesses. And he didn't care that they were survivors of the concentration camp. Hmm. That didn't even bother them. You know, because also by the time these people come in, think about this, they don't look the way they did when they were at the camp. You know, it's a different looking person that's on that witness stand. Mm-hmm. You know, and Kapisa said all the witnesses from the communities and countries, you know, I mean, he just said they were, you know, they were just all part of a big, that was a great part. They were just all part of they were all part of a plot against him. It was a conspiracy, you know, from the communists. So, you know, the communists were plotting against him. So he was always the victim, always the victim. He didn't do anything
and
wrong.
And that was right to
right to
his
day
dying
died,
day.
Yeah.
Had no remorse.
He died
whatsoever.
Lived a good old life. He died in 1985.
Mm-hmm. Of natural causes.
Yeah, and I tried to get in touch with the daughters. You know, you mentioned the daughters, but there's two living now. One has passed, but they wouldn't talk. I mean, which is understandable, but I couldn't get them to talk. Yeah. I mean, when you're doing research for a book like this, you try your hardest in every way, shape, and form, and you do the best you can, but no, they were, you know. And the other thing I find interesting for me personally, I couldn't find one single picture of him in uniform. And I mean, the both of us, you know, John and myself, are very good at finding documents and papers. But I tried everywhere. I had every, you know, any place you can think, historical archives, I went through everything. I couldn't find one of him. I mean, there's very few pictures of him, actually. There's not that many of him. And I tried to find, you know, family pictures. I mean, don't you find, though, I'm sorry to bring this up because we're going backwards, but didn't you find it extraordinary in the book when they could go on their weekend vacations and sing and dance and sing? I mean, it was just chilling to me that, you know, let's take the weekend off, and then they could see the smoke coming out the chimneys, and they would say they could smell that sweet smell of flesh. I mean, it's like, you know, you talk about a horror movie. I mean, it was just, and when I think the dog got shot, and they were more upset about that, you know. It was, you know, their personal leave, you know, or whether it was for Christmas or whatever, you know. It just was such an odd, it's just very surreal.
The other part of this horror story, and people have heard this, but you do talk about this briefly, is the Operation Paperclip. Just to add to this horror, tell us a bit about that.
Well, we want to talk about Operation Paperclip. Operation Paperclip, for example, was a large American program that recruited more than 700 Nazi engineers and rocket scientists after the war. They worked on things. Some were brought back from the U.S., Britain for interrogation. A few of those, like former, you know, V2 rocket inventor Werner von Braun, went to work for NASA. So, I mean, you know, they made use of these people. What can I say? Go ahead. Sorry.
Sorry, you talk about IG Farben in this as well, and the company was dissolved at some point.
Uh-huh.
But you do say this was called IG Auschwitz. And so tell us what the fate of the Bayer company was after all of this, the subsidiary of IG Farben, and the fate of Farben itself. And the people that were responsible in Farben.
Well, they did break the company up. The company was broken up completely. But as you said before, there was no all their sentences were commuted. So they didn't they just went on to be bigger and larger companies again. You know, the Americans after the Americans freed Capesis in 1947, the trial began of the 24 top executives from pre-war employees of IG Farben, including amongst the defendants were three directors, and they ran the company that manufactured the Zyklon B, the gas chamber. And also on trial was a director who had proved payments for some of the Auschwitz medical experiments. And when 10 of the defendants were acquitted, and the remainder given light sentences and were eventually, commuted. So, nothing, really. Nothing to say about that. It's really nothing at all. I mean, it's hard for me, I have to say, every time I see a Bayer Aspirin in CVS or Walgreens, I'm kind of like cringe to myself these days. I look at it in a whole different light.
Yeah.
Farben, Farben, remained under Allied supervision through 1949 and formally dissolved in 1951. So,
In the end of the book, you talk about, I guess, a little glimmer of hope or good news, and you talk about some prosecutions in 2005 and or 2015, pardon me. So, and new investigations. So tell us a little bit about what seems to be a little bit of good news about an attitudinal change and any kind of news in the hunt for these Nazis.
I don't know. I think there is the change. I do think there's a little bit. I don't think there's a lot. There's not many, they're also up in age these days. And of course, the problem is today when you see these men that were these strapping young men doing their thing, and now they're like old grandpas, it's so hard for people to imagine that the atrocities that these people did. So it's people tend to feel sorry for me. It wasn't me. It's you've mistaken me for someone else. And, the prosecutors around Germany, it's given there are, I think it was like you said in 2011, a German court decided the prosecutors around Germany chance to open dozens of investigations against camp guards. And I think they obtained a list of about 50. But as I say, it's the convincing, it's all the paperwork that goes through it. It's always, I think the first trial of the new investigation was in 2015 cases we talked about. And he was 95, Göring, he's a bookkeeper at Auschwitz, who was convicted and sentenced for 4 years as an accessory to the murder of 300,000. So it's very, very, they're so old, so much time has gone by. I mean, some might have dementia, Alzheimer's, dying, how do you say, was justice served? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's very, very hard. It really is to even say that. Mm. And I said, as we were in the beginning, I think there was a man that was found in Minnesota recently. And, he said to Miss, I'm not that person. You got me confused. And the son came out and said as well, I don't remember his name offhand. But, so none of them, I don't think there's any of them. I mean, there are so many have passed away that we'll never know what the answers are to that.
I think you could see the rise in neo-Nazism, and you could see a lot of people that are still denying, but I think what's interesting is that you finally get somebody in this book to get on the stand and admit to regret what they did. So I think that's about all. It's not a seismic change in attitude, but it's a change, and I think it will continue. But like you say, before the show, there's people that are 30 years old that don't know anything about this. So this is a good opportunity. This book is a fantastic primer.
Thank you.
if
yeah.
not
I
really,
agree
but
with you.
It's an
I mean,
excellent
I've always had a fascination with history and World War II, any of the wars. It'll go back all the way to the Tudor Roses for me with war. But I think that, you know, I think what makes this book, you know, what makes my book different than other Holocaust books is that the problem for many listeners is the scope and the horror of the Holocaust itself, right? Then you've got the crimes are so sweeping and the number of victims are so great that reading about it can be, you know, for some people, really overwhelming. But I feel in this book, I mean, this is how I feel. I tell a story of a single man who, and he wasn't diabolical or evil or a genius or sadistic or a Nazi henchman. You know, instead he was just an ordinary man and was capable of doing horrific things of Auschwitz, and that's what makes the story so riveting. And the feedback that I get from reviewers and readers of Advanced Copy is, you know, like yourself, they find it really, they love, you know, I mean, it's awful to say, but they relish the story. And then, of course, you've got your two main characters, you know, my guys that you know, Langbein and Bauer, do give you a lot of hope. And, you know, it's the bravery of a German prosecutor that brings Capesius there and the pursuit of a survivor. So you've got those two people that really, and so in that way, it's one of those little known tales from the Holocaust that ends on a little bit note of justice.
Yeah. Yes, because yeah. He would not have been known except for some extraordinary circumstances.
Langbein and Bauer. I mean, they were relentless. I mean, thank goodness for these two men. I mean, we would not have got, would never have got as far as we did. No, never, never. But I think that, you know, coming back to your point again, that the people are just not. I mean, people aren't as interested in that period as they used to be, or they think they know it and they don't know it. I think that's what the problem is. You know, they hear Hitler, and that's all they need to hear. They don't want to hear anything else. Or they hear the fantasy stories of, you know, Joseph Mengele living in the jungle with all these people, and that was, you know, story was so glamorized, it's just ridiculous. You know, Boys from Brazil or Marathon Man. And that's why I say my husband's book is such a great book to read. But I think even I thought I knew so much. But you know, I have family that was in the war, and I would hear stories constantly, but this, there was so much new information, like you said, the involvement, IG Farben, Bear, distribution of the money, what one had to pay for it, it was, and the gold, the way they used the gold, and it was all about, let's really be honest about it, the camp was about one thing, death and money, and Auschwitz is just one big graveyard. I mean, if it could speak, you know, the arms and the hands must be coming out of the earth. I mean, it's an amazing place to go to because it's amazing in the respect that you just feel the ground is speaking to you. It's chilling.
And I do understand for the very first time it hit home so much why Jews believe that the Holocaust should be it's their cross to bear, their word, their genocidal mass murder. Mm. And when people compare other people to Hitler, it's, I can see the offense because this really is. Pardon me, sorry?
No, sorry, carry on.
I say that it's just the, how profound that is, that anyone would compare anything else mm-hmm. to this.
Well,
and
I agree with you.
Yes, it's again, I thank you for coming on and talking about this incredible book, The Pharmacist of Auschwitz. For those that might want to, again, they can get it from Amazon and Barnes & Noble, but do you have a Facebook page for this, and how might people look at other work?
Yeah, I have a Facebook page. I have The Pharmacist of Auschwitz is called The Pharmacist of Auschwitz on my Facebook page. I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter, all of them. You know, I have a website, trishaposner.com, And so it's all there. Everything's there. They can get the book on Amazon. But I just want to add one thing for what you just said. And it's true that millions, you know, millions of Jews were killed there. But at the same time, there were non-Jews that were that were killed there. They died because they were either political prisoners, they were gay, they were mentally ill, or considered defective by whatever their standards were. And they were killed only because they were, it wasn't, they weren't only killed because they were Jewish. So there were other, you know, people that were killed. So it is, you know, all the Jews, the difference is all the Jews were killed only because they were Jewish.
Yes.
And that's what, and then what people don't really understand is that, and I just want to make this point clear, is that Hitler's dream was to annihilate every Jew, that he every Jew off of the face of the earth, so there would be no Jews left ever. It would be, his word was Judenfrei, which means Jew-free. Let's free Europe of all Jews. So it was, and very different in that respect, that this person had this desire. I mean, in the beginning, sorry, because I'm sure we have to wind up now. In the beginning, he wanted them to go to Madagascar. You know, he was going to deport them there. So, you know, it was his desire. This Judenfrei was just, he was obsessed with it. Sorry to regress back there for that. You know, it's just something, it was a thought I had there.
Yes. And it just is amazing, just to wrap up as well, is the attitude when they went for this major SS court case, that they stuck together. No one, they all believed in the same thing. They wanted to believe that they were following orders. They all felt persecuted to a great degree. There was nobody exiting this group. They all stayed steadfast to their stories. It's an incredible lack of remorse or humanity.
Humanity. Yeah, no, you put it absolutely well. I mean, you know, when you think of it, 20 years after the end of the war, there was not one that broke the SS code of silence. Not one. Not one broke the silence. So it is, you know, and I thought of that many times when I was doing the book, that if you had 7,000 people working there, it could have taken a few to get together, you know, but like you said, they were following orders, they were doing their duty, and they wouldn't break that code of silence, and their, you know, their Führer was Hitler. You know, he was the man.
Incredible.
That is,
well, Patricia,
story.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much, Patricia, for coming on and taking the time to explain this incredible book, The Pharmacist of Auschwitz, The Untold Story. Thank you very much, Patricia.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you very much, and very much for reading the book the way you did, because it's, your knowledge of it is it was wonderful. I have to say that. Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Well, it's an unforgettable book, Patricia. Thank you very much for a very, very, very important interview and an important book. Thank you. Have a great night.
And you have a great night. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.